The All Souls Forum is a weekly broadcast here on KKFI every Thursday at noon. The All Souls Forum is a production of the Universalist Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut. Each week they present a public forum whose mission is to deal with significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values of the contemporary world, and to promote critical thinking. So without further ado, here's this week's production of All Souls Forum.
So welcome. Good morning, everybody. I am Michael Duffy, a member of the All Souls UU Forum Committee, which brings me to our speaker this morning, Mr. Damon Daniel. Could you wave to us here so everybody knows who you are? All right. So he's the director right now of the Kansas City Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, and he's going to talk this morning on the subject of police reform in Kansas City. This has obviously been an important topic across the country as well as in our city. Some of you may have seen the newspaper report this morning about yet another political demonstration around this topic. We all have it on our minds, and we have truly an exceptional speaker this morning to help us think through these issues and answer our questions. So with that, I'll turn that over to Damon Daniel.
Thank you, Mr. Duffy. And thank you all for this wonderful invitation to come to speak to you all today. I recognize that not very many, perhaps, congregations in our community is pausing regular program services to discuss such an important topic that we are facing today. Just to give you all a little bit of background on myself as well as the organization as well, I come to Ad Hoc Group Against Crime with 20 years of experience working in the community and a history of working with various faith leaders from across the region, along with elected officials and community members, to advocate for social justice that affect everyday life. The Ad Hoc Group Against Crime has served the Kansas City metropolitan area for over 40 years. In fact, it was founded by Mr. Alvin Brooks, really during a time when racial segregation was freshly worn on the shoulders of those who marched and died for civil rights. I would just say, just to kind of go into a little bit of depth about the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime and sort of our history and where we are today. Many of you, I'm sure, if you're from Kansas City, you know the history, but some may not. And so therefore, Ad Hoc was formed in 1977. Really, it was in response to nine African-American women who were considered women of the evening. And they were all homicide victims and were killed along the Prospect Corridor. And if folks remember, in the mid-70s to late-70s, on the East Coast, there was a serial killer on the loose. And they even made a movie about it, Summer of Sam. But back then, I think they called him the Colt 45 killer. And this individual focused on white women who were all brunettes, all lived in the same area. And folks here in Kansas City thought that, hey, there must be a serial killer on the loose here in Kansas City, because the focus was all African-American women. They all fit the same profile. But the problem was, it was getting very little attention, particularly by local law enforcement, because the attitude was, well, they live that lifestyle and those are the consequences of that lifestyle. And so therefore, those homicides got very little attention. And so this ad hoc group of concerned citizens came together to raise awareness as well as hold police accountable for solving those crimes. And this was really before, TIPS Hotline really came about. And therefore, we partnered with Carter Broadcast Group. We did PSAs and telethons to raise money and raise awards to help solve those crimes. And we did. We solved quite a bit of those. And that group decided to stick together and form what's known today as the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime. But in the early 80s and 90s, it was really considered a radical crime-fighting agency. And I say radical because we would partner with local funeral homes, and we would take a casket and sit it out in front of a drug house, and it would be, 100 people. And back then we had an auxiliary group called the Black Men Together. And the Black Men Together all wore sort of these blue jackets, and they would show up with a bullhorn. They would knock on a door. They had done their own surveillance at the time, and they would show pictures to the folks and say, look, if you don't shut it down, we'll be back, and the police would be on the periphery. And they shut down some 200 or so drug houses back then in the early 80s and 90s. In fact, made it on the cover of USA Today, and George Bush Sr. came to Kansas City with the first drug czar to really examine the strategies in which Ad Hoc had been going about shutting down drug houses. And so we were certainly considered very radical back then. And you fast forward a bit to the early 2000s. Those of you who are from Kansas City, you know Mr. Brooks is a well-known civic leader and former city councilman, mayor pro tem, and also was on the police board of commissioners and retired police detective as well. But he decided to step away in 2000, and the organization had merged with Operation, Project Neighborhood, and formed what was known as Move Up. And Move Up was in existence between 2000 and 2007. However, it kind of got away from its original mission of providing core victim services for those impacted by crime and violence. And Mr. Brooks never stopped getting calls related to the homicide. So Ad Hoc was rebirthed. And as I like to say, we've been ad hocing ever since. But what we've come a long way from, the radical drug, shutting down drug houses to providing a number of services that range from free grief counseling to even civil rights monitoring that we do in Westport as well. And, I would say that, I don't want to list all of our services that we provide. I would encourage you all to visit our website sometime. But I would say one of our, most crucial services is really providing crisis case management and counseling to victims. Their families, victims and their families that have witnessed or been impacted by violent crime. We take the steps towards, we help them take the steps towards stability in their daily lives and experience improved, help them really experience some improvement in their mental health, therefore reducing their level of anger and trauma. And as you address those issues, the pursuit of retaliation declines significantly. Our ad hoc staff members help witnesses and families address their multiple needs and redirecting them to a positive path and assuring them that ad hoc would not only help them find resources to meet their housing needs, daily needs, but also directly advocate for them with law enforcement, employers, schools, and landlords, and walk alongside victims and their families who in helping them witnessing sort of the calming effects and prevent their emotions from spiraling out of control because they have been advocating, because we have been advocating to help them deal with those life-altering needs resulting in victimization. And so that kind of gives you a little bit of an overview of some of the services that we do and sort of the core service that we provide. Of course, occasionally we have an opportunity to partner with law enforcement, or if some of you may have heard in the news recently where we partnered with Congressman Cleaver's office and Amazon Ring, where we were able to leverage 1,500 much needed cameras to neighborhoods that have high rates of crime and violence. And we've done all of this in the midst of somewhat turbulent times. When you think about the killing of George Floyd, which sparked nationwide protests and the call for racial justice. Even here recently in the last, I would say, about 90 days, where five Kansas City, Missouri Police Department officers were indicted for misconduct, and where several community organizations have called for the resignation of the chief of police, while all at the same time struggling to stay safe in a global pandemic, while still experiencing, I would say, potentially Kansas City's most violent year. So this topic today is really about, I would say, the impact of violence and the struggle to achieve healing and justice. Now, with the limited amount of time that I have with you all, I wanted to spend my time, really kind of focusing on the power of relationship and the importance of strengthening those relationships to achieve justice. Now, this conversation, of course, is rooted in the context of, I would say, community violence, which is still indeed a very broad topic. But as much as I can, I will attempt to drill down on some specific examples of both problems and perhaps strategies to reduce the impact of violence and build relationships at the same time. And I'm really looking forward to having a conversation with you all as well. Now, as a native of Kansas City, and many of you, I'm sure, are as well, you know the history of the racial and economic segregation here in Kansas City. And perhaps you've even witnessed or live in neighborhoods where the impact of those racialized policies that have led to the concentration of violence in many of the neighborhoods that are experiencing it today. And to kind of unpack that a little bit, I'll talk about that. Some of you, you know, who were born in the, you know, 1960s or 70s, you know, may have witnessed the struggle the African Americans had when it came to the rights to vote, and moreover, how important it is to exercise that very right. And so I'll touch on that just a little bit because we're, I think, 50 days out from the election as well. But just to kind of talk a little bit about this issue of violence, you know, violence affects all of us, whether directly or indirectly. And the thing about violence in Kansas City, particularly homicides, you know, it really comes down to relationships. Now, I always say that relationships can enrich our lives, both professionally and personally. Yet some of us tend to surround ourselves with toxic relationships that can contaminate our potential. While healthy relationships, of course, lift us up, molds us into being better people, and cheer us on even to do good and or even great things. And as a leader of a nonprofit that serves the Kansas City metropolitan area, particularly as a trusted bridge between the community and the criminal justice system, I receive notifications of homicides along with a daily analysis. And this analysis simply provides a snapshot of the motives behind the homicides and how many are solved or unsolved, types of weapons being used, demographics, age, sex, race, et cetera. Now, some of these homicides are the result of two strangers who pass cross. They get into a conflict and they resolve it with violence. Then there are those we lose to violence as a result of poor choices, or I would say shady friends. And in some cases, it is classified as domestic violence, not necessarily intimate partner relationship violence. But in many cases, it is young people who know each other, run in the same circles, maybe went to the same schools, they get into a conflict and they resolve it with violence. And then of course, retaliation is also one of the last motives that's on the list. And if we were to examine the issue of violence, perhaps through a health lens, we could say that parts of our community has a contagious disease, maybe even a deadly disease. We could say that violence is transmitted from one person to another, or that it is passed down from one generation to the next. Many of us come into contact with this deadly contagious disease through fractured relationships, where conditioned side effects of violence are more subtle, because we witness family members resolve problems or conflict with it. For our youth that grow up around this behavior, they develop a serious infection with the sudden set of symptoms that result in the disregarding of the sanctity of life. But like most diseases, it can be treated and eventually cured. So in other words, if violence is a learned behavior, it can be unlearned as well. And I'm always encouraging people to say, you know the first step is to make room for forgiveness and practice kind acts. Listen, excuse me, I recognize that that sounds very simple, but honestly, sometimes when we look at complex issues, sometimes it's taking the most simple approaches as well. So particularly when we talk about violence and how a lot of our violence acts that we are experiencing in our city is due to poor behavior. So if our younger generation can become witnesses to forgiveness and practice kind acts, we can begin to break the cycle of violence and begin to create a healthier and safer community. But let me just give you all sort of this picture of what we're really dealing with here. You know, the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department recorded 5,225 aggravated assault reports in 2019, in addition to 150 homicides, which is one shy of the current five-year high of 151, which dates back to 2017. Unfortunately, right now in 2020, homicides are on pace to already to exceed even last year's. We're at 139 as of September 11th, as of Friday, September 11th. That's nearly 28% higher than the 109 victims at the same time last year. And to date, 31% of homicides were young people that were the age of 24 or younger. And they also made up 23% of the suspects. Folks who look like me, black males, accounted for 64% of victims and 58% of suspects. Although the motives of these are largely unknown, the most frequent is an argument. In fact, I believe it's 35 cases of those 139 that have been tracked so far is due to an argument. When I look at these stats, though, I recognize that there's a much larger system at play. You know, for example, Kansas City is roughly 300 square miles, yet the majority of violent crime happens within a 34 square miles of in Kansas City. That's 34 square miles of inequity that has led to Kansas City being one of the most violent cities in America. Think about that for a minute. Now, within those 34 square miles, it's well over 2,000 vacant homes. And it said the vacant homes can lead to a domino effect when it comes to the production of crime. It is said that 1%, a 1% increase in foreclosures, for example, can lead to more boarded up homes, vacant houses. And then there's a 2.3% jump in violent crime in that neighborhood. So think about that. If you got over 2,000 vacant homes, and even with one vacant home is a 1% increase, that's what we're really experiencing here. Many of these neighborhoods have low performing schools, low wage jobs with little or no benefits and little access to full service grocery stores. In addition, don't be a person who just got out of prison. Formerly incarcerated individuals face an uphill battle when it comes to employment and housing. Many of you have heard the statistics. You know, the U.S. makes up 12% of the world's population, but incarcerates nearly 24% of it. One in every 31 Americans were in prison or on probation or parole. Those are staggering statistics. So welcoming formerly incarcerated individuals back into society requires inclusive policies and practices. For example, not long ago, Kansas City City Council passed the Ban the Box, the question on employment applications that asks, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Kansas City needs more second chance employers, property owners. After all, if we want a person to change after incarceration, they must begin with their environment. So a change in venue can create opportunities to thrive. Some time ago, as I mentioned, I had done a lot of work around social justice, and I had the pleasure of working for an organization called CCO, Communities Creating Opportunities, for a number of years. And I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. John Powell, who at the time was at the Curran Institute of Race and Ethnicity, who is now at Berkeley. And he once said that opportunities are racialized, spatialized, and globalized. Racialized meaning that because of the color of your skin, you have access to opportunities. One example to lend is, you know, let's look at Brown versus Board of Education. We had to have policies so that people of color can have access to quality education. You know, when he talks about opportunities or spatialized, what he's saying is that where you live really does matter. It can have an impact on your life expectancy. I grew up in the zip code of 64130, actually within the Blue Hills neighborhood. And, you know, not long ago, Blue Hills neighborhood, or I should say this, the 64130 zip code was deemed the murder factory. And when you look at what occurred in that neighborhood. It was one of the first neighborhoods that experienced blockbusting, which was a real estate, illegal real estate actions that folks would say, you know, when DSEG happened, you know, Blacks were able to move further south. And when they did that, you had real estate agents that would come and knock on the doors of white folks and say, hey, the Blacks are moving in and they're going to, you know, bring violence and tear up the neighborhood. And so you should move. And they did a lot of that. And when those folks, when Blacks moved into many of those neighborhoods, they were sold toxic loans, loans with adjustable rate mortgages that went from, you know, maybe a 3% to double digits in some cases after a while, which led to what we are experiencing, what we've seen today with a lot of the vacant houses as well. But that point about where you live has an impact on your life expectancy. You know, there were studies done by the Kansas City, Missouri Health Department that talked about, you know, what we would consider food deserts. I like to use the term food apartheid, because food deserts imply that there was some natural causation behind the lack or scarcity of quality foods, when in fact it's man-made and designed. And so that's another issue. Globalized, as Dr. Powell talks about, meaning that simply because of your economic status, you have access to things that others do not. And I would go a step further in adding to Dr. Powell's opportunity lens, and to say that opportunity is also genderized, if I could stick with rhyming, you know, racialized, spatialized, globalized, but based on gender as well. Still today in 2020, we have women in the same industry or positions that make less than men in those same positions in our industries as well. And so we still have a long way to go. And just sticking with that example of how opportunities are racialized, when you think about, you know, there's a disturbing 1 in 12 white Americans are unemployed, right? And the unemployment picture is staggering for most communities of color. 1 in 6 Blacks and 1 in 8 Latinos are jobless, while overall 1 in 13 Asians are unemployed as well. So let's talk about improving our justice system. In order to improve our justice system, we must become more active in the political process. That means not only registering to vote, but showing up to the polls. We are indeed, I believe, 50 days out from November 3rd. And if I were to really drill down, I would say we are 50 days, 14 hours, 36 minutes, and 57, 56, 55 seconds away from the election. And I'm really paying attention and focusing on this election, because it is so important for us to make sure that people are actively engaged in the political process. And so I would love to see All Souls Church take souls to the polls in November as well. And it's extremely important, because there are fractions of our community that will never fully be represented, because large majorities of minorities are not voting. Therefore, equality as it pertains to our justice system would not become a reality. So show up, Kansas City, and vote. Your vote is indeed your voice. Now, I want to sort of begin to wrap up some of my comments. Those of you who may have read my bio somewhere or something like that may know that prior to me coming to Ad Hoc, I was in seminary, and I left seminary to run the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime. And I did that because, you know, this is my ministry. It's not a job for me. It is what I believe God has called me to be doing at this moment in time. And I often think about the scripture in Luke chapter 10, verse 1 through 11. I'm not going to read all of it, but I often ask the question, you know, as God works miracles in our lives, the question is, what has he called us to be doing during this moment in time? And I think about that scripture where the Lord appointed 70 and sent them out of head in pairs to every town and place where he himself intended to go. And whether we go with the number 70 or 72, the point is that Luke is making is that the Lord's mission is growing in influence. What started with one person, Jesus, expands at first to 12 and the calling of the disciples. And the story of the commissioning of the 70, the number of persons engaged in the very same mission as Jesus, and the 12 increases sixfold. By the time we come to Luke's second volume, the Acts of Apostles, there are 3,000 persons added to the ranks on the day of Pentecost. Only two chapters later, in response to the preaching of Peter and John, the believers numbered somewhere around about 5,000. At the heart, though, of the mission is not merely addressing the issues, but building an organization. That is what Luke is describing, I believe. That is an organization that is being built based on a broad base of leaders, not a movement confined to a solitary, charismatic leader. Jesus does not hang on to the mission himself as if he's the only person who can carry it out. That would have limited the impact, I believe, of his influence and combining results to himself alone, and really to relatively to the few places that he himself was able to go. So what Jesus does, however, is to release the mission to others as he sends them ahead to places where he himself intended to go, but presumably could not. And in sending persons out in pairs, two by two, the mission builds into accountability. Isolated, solidary individuals bent on doing things on their own need not apply. The mission carried out is about partnership. It is about building communities. So he said to them, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, ask the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." Now, the need addressed by the mission is overwhelming. The harvest of human hurt is plentiful indeed. Even when one focuses close to home, thinking globally, acting locally, the problems faced by families in our cities are massive. Who does not feel small and insignificant when faced with seemingly insurmountable challenges? But the same metaphor also expresses a sense of urgency about this mission. When the crops are ripe, they must be reaped. Harvest season is always a time of great urgency. We do not have the luxury of waiting until tomorrow to begin to organize ourselves. He said, "Go on your way. See, I am sending you out like lambs in the midst of wolves." This plentiful harvest of human need is not much a problem as it is an opportunity. As long as the challenge remains a problem, it is elusive, too complex, bewildering to address, right? Once a problem is turned into an issue, however, it becomes manageable and achievable. To think in terms of issues rather than problems is to be on our way already. When I used to do organizing, and even when my challenge, even as I, run the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime and I look at these big problems of mass incarceration and violence, I try to think about it like a loaf of bread. You never sit down and eat a whole loaf in one sitting, right? It's sliced up, so you have to take it in slices. So this mission is really not for the faint-hearted. There will be considerable resistance to overcome, as we've seen thus far. The families of our communities are like the innocents when pitted against well-organized money, special interest groups who have so much power. Now, power simply means the ability to act, but there is more than one kind of power, more than one kind of way to effectively act and to bring about change. In addition to the power of money, there is the power of relationships. Those who Jesus sends out on this mission are like lambs armed with the power of relationships. confronting those who are like wolves armed with the power of money. It is not without risk to be a lamb in the midst of wolves, which is why it is essential that lambs be well organized. My friends, my vision for my community is one that is united with and armed with love, hope, and faith. I want to just stop there because I can go on and on, but I really want to engage you all in this dialogue.
All right. See, we're still learning here. Ms. Daniel, thank you so much. That was very, very inspirational. Let's just take a moment here for a few announcements. And typically at this point in our forum, we would pass the basket. Of course, that's a little difficult on Zoom. So for those who wish to make a contribution to the church that supports these kinds of activities, please look in your chat box and you will see information about how to make a donation. While you're looking at that, I'll announce that our forum presentation next week is on the topic of religion and the media. Very often we have noticed that religion has become quite politicized. And Linda Seeger will be our speaker to talk about misrepresentation of religion's role in the political system. We will continue to offer these forums on a weekly basis, and we're glad to see that we actually have more participants than we expected this morning. So welcome, everybody. Thank you for navigating through our Zoom process. We'll take just 2 minutes where I'll be quiet, and this will give you a chance to get up and stretch and make a donation if you wish. And we'll be back in just 2 minutes for question and answers. And when we come back for questions, look on your screen for how to raise your hand. I don't mean physically raise your hand, but there's a button on your screen that shows you how to raise your hand. Please find that and I will call on you. And again, please confine your comments to questions. Make them brief so we can give everybody a turn who wants to ask questions. So we'll be back in 2 minutes.
I think you're muted.
There you go. We're back to order here. Thank you for reminding me. We're getting used to this. Damon Daniel, thank you so much again. And we've got a couple of people I see with their hands up. And Richard Thompson, why don't you go ahead? I see your hands up. You have a question.
Yes. Damon, to what extent do you think we can use crime prevention through environmental design to help be proactive and prevent crime and sort of issues associated with urban blight?
That, you know, I'm really glad you asked that question. You must know that I have my certification in crime prevention through environmental design. Let me just give 10 ways I think that crime prevention through environmental design can help. One is I would say keep it lit, you know, and actually what I'll do, I have 10 crime and safety tips that you can stop criminals from entering your home or choosing your home. And so I'll send that out to folks as well. So one, you know, keeping things lit, which light discourages homes from being broken into for two obvious reasons. First, light gives the impression that someone is home. Second, light makes it easier for criminals to be seen and identified. I would say number two, use radio and TV. So when you leave your home, help create the impression that it's occupied by playing talk radio station or TV as well. Three, fortify your doors. A properly fortified door can't be kicked in. You can reinforce a basic wooden door with a few inexpensive metal strike plates and things of that nature. Four, guard your windows. So to help stop criminals from choosing your home, walk around the premises and examine your windows with a criminal mindset, right? Or basement windows. Basement windows easier to open protecting with metal gates or bars and things like that. Make sure that they're higher up. The higher up windows are not accessible either by trees that go over your home or things like that. I think number five, lock away objects, helpful objects, I would say. So homeowners sometimes make criminals' job easy by providing the tools. So store your ladders and stackable items in a locked area. Avoid placing them on the table or other item near your home where it might be used to as a step, like, you know, so your snow shovels or other potential break-in items that can be used. Don't stash a key. The most helpful object for an intruder is a house key, right? So don't stash keys. Prevent outdoor hiding is another. That's number seven. So trees and bushes can conceal prowlers. So by keeping your property well maintained, you can make sure that overgrowth doesn't provide hiding spots. And then number eight, I would say maintain your property. As mentioned previously, you know, those hiding spot, it also conveys an impression that you're on the ball, which makes your home exterior in general, you know, like the paint, for example, or pavement and so forth. So to show that you take pride in your property leaves the impression that you might own a home security system as well. And if you do, display a yard sign or windows or those stickers that promote that as well. That's also helpful. You know, some say grease the drain pipe. Now, it might sound, you know, cartoonish, but criminals really do climb on drain pipes. So to foil this home invasion strategies, homeowners sometimes can coat metal drain pipes with slippery substances such as petroleum jelly. And then, of course, organize with your neighborhood as well. Organize with your neighborhood association too. So those are sort of 10 tips that are, I think, directly related to crime prevention through environmental design.
That's an organized answer.
Well, you know, I don't know why I had that handy here in my notes, because I'm always trying to give people really concrete things that they can do that are not that complex.
That's great. We've got another question. I don't have a name, just a phone number. That's 343-18. Who is that? Go ahead and ask your question.
Damon, you talked about, I think, 35 cases this year of homicides that were a result of disputes. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that too in reading about the descriptions of these incidences. What do you think is the impact of such wide availability of guns? In other words, if two people get in a dispute and one of them gets really angry, one of them reaches for their gun and the other, well, you know the story. Mm-hmm. So what is the impact of wide availability of guns in our community, and is there anything much can be done about it?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Guns have been made too easy for people to acquire. And in fact, you know, in the last few years, actually last 4 or 5 years now, the state of Missouri particularly has just, the legislature has gone in the complete wrong direction, in my opinion, as it relates to gun safety. They've lowered the age. They've taken away the fact that you have to have a license to carry. Those are two crucial, I think, mistakes that have led to more youth having access to guns. And, you know, I was just looking at a report last week where a mother and her four-year-old daughter had just arrived at a park for her daughter to play. And as the daughter got out of the vehicle, the mom was right, you know, getting out of her car, coming right behind her. A rolling gun battle happened, and the four-year-old got shot in the leg. You know, this is that is the impact that it's having. Innocent people, innocent bystanders are being shot because of the readily available guns. I'm not, you know, one of those that are advocating to take guns out of the hands of people. I'm really talking about how do we increase responsible gun ownership, and how do we make sure that that we're keeping guns safe, you know, as well. You know, one of the other issues that we have is people aren't putting their guns up or not locking them up as well, and not keeping them out of the arm reach of children. And so you have a lot of accidental deaths that are occurring too. And when you take a class, they teach you, you know, not only, you know, the proper, you know, the law and carrying a gun, but they also teach you proper storage and how to handle a gun more correctly. Those are things that we need to go back and make sure that are back in place as well. And so it is having a devastating impact on our communities when you talk about the availability of guns in our streets.
All right, anybody?
And I'll just say this too. I think, but we also need to look at online purchases as well. We need to find out how we can limit online purchasing, because not only are you able to go to pawn shops and gun stores, but you can buy guns online, and a lot of the guns that you can buy online are more exotic, and the sellers don't necessarily have to abide by your state laws. You're the one who's a buyer that has to do that as well. And so really looking at just common sense gun laws is really what we need.
George Baggett, you have a question.
Yes. The majority of deaths appear to be in the zip code you talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And I live in the inner city. I live 35th and South and Southwest Traffic Way, approximately. Mm-hmm. And the other day I was driving over to a friend's house on Benton, and on Main Street, about 300 small motorcycle kids came by with doing wheelies and running the red light. There must have been at least I estimate about 300. There seems to be, and I don't know what to do about it. What do you suppose we can do about a certain level of anarchy that seems to be prevalent throughout the community, not just not just the Black community, but in the city? They're causing traffic issues, putting themselves at risk. In fact, I was expecting to be seeing somebody that had a problem, that we had to go pick one of these kids off the street. And so I don't know what the answer is, but it seems to be prevalent not only in the Black community, but around the whole city. Yeah. What do you think about that?
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, and this is I hope I answered your question, but, you know, I just had a discussion with two law enforcement officers yesterday afternoon about what's happening at Soar Park. It's a similar situation where you have folks that are gathering. There's an activity, I would say, that's called burn your tires or whatever it's called. It's sort of, I don't know if any of you have seen the movie like Fast and Furious or anything like that, but there's sort of that environment where you have a lot of people who bring their fast cars and they like to spin their tires, and then you have motorcycles that come out as well, and people just kind of set up and that's the atmosphere. And it's not that anything's wrong with that. It's happening at a park. But it's what happens later at night where folks are, I think just a couple of weeks ago, six people were shot at Toll Park following an incident. And really, it's one of those incidents where there was an argument. And so we're trying to look at what are the ways that we can increase safety in that area and around those kinds of activities. Because there are, in some ways, there are some organizers that do it as well. And I think the part of the solution is for the community itself to get engaged and to be more present, especially, you know, I think that's an area where the church can be more involved. That's an area where sororities and fraternities can be more involved. It's an area where even I think a lot of these community organization groups can be more engaged as well, and look at how we all come together to sort of rotate weekends and to be present out there and providing resource material But also, you know, when you have situations where you have people who are hanging out, they're drinking, they're smoking, and they don't, there's not a sort of what I like to call an elder, or, you know, in the streets we say an OG sort of presence. You're limited to how you can control that environment when things began to spin out of control. And so we're having these discussions. We're going to be engaging in these discussions actually in the next couple of weeks to look at how do we increase the community's presence so that we're not asking police to be present, because the police have already said, hey, you know, we don't really want to immerse ourselves into that. We think that the community should really be responding to that. And so, you know, I'm going to be calling on community organizations and churches to be more engaged in that process. And we need places for people to go and play with the big boy toys, you know, as well. I have a motorcycle, but I'm not good enough to pop wheelies on it or anything like that. But I think that we need to have places for people to go and do those kind of things and enjoy those kinds of things. But we also need the presence of more positive folks to be in the midst of that to help control that environment. Because otherwise, if we have to depend on the police department to be there, we're going to see an increase in arrests and so many other things that, you know, they don't want to be put in that position. And we shouldn't put them in that position.
I'm going to stop you there because we have another question. Mike Hoy.
Yeah, Damon, question for you. What is the impact of the federal government in regards to law enforcement in the Black community from the FBI's COINTELPRO aggression against the Black Panthers in the 60s to today's fusion centers and the 1033 program and the surge of federal agents this summer? How does that impact the Black community in particular?
Yeah, great question. You know, I've said on the onset, particularly with in Operations Legend, with the influx of federal agents in the city, that it will not decrease violent crime, but it will certainly increase incarceration. And I think we've seen that. When you talk about, though, the historic relationship between, you know, the federal government and organized by, like, the Black Panthers, for example, I think that the FBI, I went through the FBI's Citizen Academy a few years ago, and that kind of came up a little bit. And I think the FBI has acknowledged their role in that and are looking for ways in which they can be more engaged in the community in that regard. I did ask recently, though, of the special agent in charge of our local FBI how they feel about the Black militia that has been, you know, showing up to protect Black Lives Matter protests in various parts of the country. And they appreciate it because they've seen it be more peaceful and recognize that people are exercising their constitutional rights in that regard. But we've, you know, when you talk about the use of federal agents when it comes to this issue of violence in our city, or even the use of federal agents when it comes to protests, it is not, in my opinion, the way to go about addressing what people are asking for. It is totally ignoring the call for justice, and it further deteriorates or adds to the deterioration of the relationship and trust that could exist between the community, between the Black community particularly, and law enforcement. It does not improve it whatsoever. And so when you interject, or when you bring in federal agents to a peaceful protest, it shows that you're not really listening to the calls that those who are out there protesting. And so, and just like here in Kansas City, when we've seen the protests on the plaza back in, you know, May or June, where those calls for, you know, reforms have yet to be addressed. And so that's why we're still seeing protests. And as so, I think those law enforcement agencies have to listen, but then they also have to take action as it relates to meeting those demands of the community for which they are here to serve.
Damon, I'm going to jump in with a question here, and anybody else, please raise your hand if you have another question. But you, Damon, have been quoted in the newspaper as calling for the resignation of the Kansas City police chief. Mm-hmm. Share your thoughts on that. Why are you calling for that? What's needed? What's wrong with the current administration? What changes are needed?
Yeah, you know, I'll say this. You know, we did join efforts to call for his resignation, really with the fact that, number one, homicides are at an all-time high. This increase, even in the face of the fact that, you know, he dismantled effective strategies that reduce violence as well, like, for example, KC Nova, and placed in, you know, and replaced it with ineffective strategies like the Tampa model, which has no significant reduction in violent crime. The trust between the Black community and law enforcement has not improved. And there has been no, you know, effort to in placing people of color in leadership positions within the Kansas City Police Department. There hasn't really been a significant increase in the number of officers of color graduating from the academy either. You know, when it came to the issue of probable cause statements when requested to align with standard operating procedures, he did not send that over. And then, you know, even recently, you know, when we talk about those five, I mentioned earlier, five police officers have been indicted here recently for misconduct. You know, that the last officer that was just indicted, you know, that was a veteran sergeant that had a suspect in custody and basically assaulted that 15-year-old suspect, knocked his teeth out, all of that. And the officer community complaints, you know, sustained the complaint and recommended action be taken, and nothing happened. In fact, that officer is still on the force, still on payroll. There was never really any action taken. And I think the police board of commissioners have condoned that behavior. We haven't seen Chief Smith come out and denounce that type of behavior at all. In fact, he's stood by those officers as well. And that, again, is just another example of what adds to that lack of trust and deterioration between the Black community and the police department. And so also stood out or supported that because of the treatment of even the protesters as well.
We have another question from Renee Price.
Yeah, I just wanted to know what the update is on the body cams, because that was one tangible item that did get talked about this summer. Yeah. But then I haven't heard a thing about it since then.
Yeah, so they've been going through a test run of those body cams. And to my understanding, they're going to be rolling them out very soon. I think part of what they were trying to make sure that they have in place before they actually go live with it are the policies that are involved with the cameras. For example, part of the technology involved with the body cam is, so when an officer pulls someone over and they get out the car, that body cam is supposed to automatically come on. And so I think part of this discussion around policies and practices is, at what point can the officer turn the camera off? So for example, if they're responding to a domestic violence call, domestic violence disturbance, and they come in and the person is, you know, maybe nude or not dressed or whatever, and they want to turn their camera off, you know, what they have not worked out what is appropriate, when is it appropriate, and the training behind all of that. So a lot of that still has to be worked out. But the technology, the cameras, all those things are in place. I think the storage of those videos, all of that, I think, has also been addressed. I think now they're just at that place where they're just trying to work out the policies and practices and all of that. And so it's going to take a while. I think they prematurely, you know, said, oh, it's going to be, you know, we can get this out in 60 days, not having any of that other stuff that I just mentioned worked out. And so
I'll stop you right there, Damon, because we're just about out of time for one final real quick question. Evelyn Maddox has had her hand up. Evelyn, could you make it real quick?
Yes, thank you. Damon, could you explain to us, please, what authority this appointed board of commissioners, you know, the state of what we refer to as a state board, mm-hmm. explain to us how much authority it has to make reform locally?
And again, we have just 1 minute.
They have complete authority to make those changes. That's the quick and short answer. They are appointed by the governor. However, they have the authority to make changes when it comes to those things. But they also have to do that in conversation with the chief of police as well.
And we don't hear any conversation about changing the appointees. Would you favor changing the appointees?
I do favor local control. I think that's the only way we can change the appointees is through a local control process.
All right, well, we'll wrap it up here. Damon, Daniel, thank you so much. Normally this is where we would clap for you, so we can't do that. And we would give you a little honorary mug or something like that, but we can't do that either. So instead, I'll just again say thank you so much. Very thoughtful presentation. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. And we can definitely continue this conversation October 20th. I think I provided a flyer and a mask
right now. Yep.
So October 20th, we have invited Ta-Nehisi Coates to join us in talking about this epidemic of violence and how we got here. And so we're going to peel back the layers of redlining, over-policing, low-wage jobs, inadequate education, et cetera, et cetera. And so join us October 20th at 6:30. It's a free event. But you can go to our website. I think it's live now as well, and register to vote. I mean, register to vote. Well, yes, go register to vote, but you registered to participate in that conversation as well. It's going to be, I think, a wonderful conversation. And we're going to have a lot of next steps coming out of that, too.
Thank you for tuning in to All Souls Forum. Keep your dial tuned right here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, for your jazz afternoon coming up immediately with KC, followed by the Boogie Bridge with Jason Bologna at 3 p.m., and then the Heartland Labor Forum, 6 p.m. this evening. In the meantime, have a great day.